U.S.-Cuba relations, the Vatican, and the economics of the poor in Cuba. From APM in New York, I'm David Brancaccio. More now on thawing relations between the U.S. and Cuba after that prisoner swap yesterday. While the U.S. trade embargo cannot be lifted without repealing the very strict Helms-Burton law, the Obama administration does have the leeway to allow exports that helps the smallest of businesses in Cuba, people who are self-employed. It also frees up people in the U.S. to send money to relatives, remittances. The deal also puts the spotlight on the leader of the Roman Catholic Church, who was directly involved in pushing Havana and Washington closer. The BBC's Vatican correspondent David Willey has been following Pope Francis's diplomatic efforts.
The Pope has at his disposal a very, very capable diplomatic service. He has ambassadors in over 100 different countries all over the world. Although the Vatican resources are rather small in comparison to those of the United States, Vatican diplomats are very respected. The advice is frequently sought by different states from the Secretary of State, who's the Pope's number two, and indeed under special circumstances by the Pope himself.
To what extent can we say, do you think, that the economic conditions of people under communism in Cuba is driving the Pope's interest in the situation in Cuba?
He's very interested in the plight of poor and marginalized people and knows perhaps better than anyone else, certainly the most heads of state, what it's like to work among the poor. You mustn't forget that when he was Archbishop of Buenos Aires, he spent a lot of his time meeting very poor people in the slums, and he's put the plight of the poor as the number one priority of his papacy.
The BBC's David Willey in Rome is just finishing a book about Pope Francis. Mr. Willey, thank you.
Thank you.
Some U.S. politicians have been pointedly critical of the Pope's role here. A possible 2016 presidential contender, Senator Marco Rubio, said he would ask Pope Francis, quote, to take up the cause of freedom and democracy in Cuba. Rubio represents Florida, is a Catholic and Cuban-American. Nike reports profits later today. The 12th edition of a LeBron James basketball shoe came out this fall, and 30 years in, Michael Jordan remains a top brand. Marketplace's Dan Weissman reports.
From Wall Street, Nike looks good. John Kernan is an analyst with Cowen and Company.
The brand is on fire, pretty much across geographies, across categories.
Across geographies means places like Europe, China, and Brazil, as well as at home in the U.S. Across categories means general sportswear, not just sneakers.
And they've been pushing through price increases.
Those price increases have not gone down well with David Rasul Robinson's customers. He's a manager at St. Alfred, Chicago's top sneaker boutique. Sneakerheads love Nike, but this year, he says, they're disappointed. Other brands raise prices too, but they don't have the quality control problems he sees creeping into a lot of Nike offerings.
There's not errant glue stains. Shoes aren't blowing out after being worn a couple times, or paint's not chipping on the sole.
I asked John Kerner if Robinson's critiques give him any pause.
No, none. Nike's a gigantic company. I'd have to hear it from somebody more than just this guy.
So, sneakerheads, outliers or leading edge indicators? In Chicago, I'm Dan Weissman for Marketplace.
Hi, this is David Brancaccio, host of the Marketplace Morning Report. Marketplace has been on the air for 25 years, and that could not have happened without support from listeners like you. So please, if you can, make a tax-deductible gift to Marketplace today and help us keep our coverage relevant and compelling. And you should know that your gift, really in any amount, counts twice thanks to a dollar-for-dollar match from the Candida Fund. Donate at marketplace.org by December 31st and help us reach our goal of at least 2,500 donors. Thanks for your support. Let me introduce the next interview with this generalization. Americans are a bold people who made this country great by embracing risk. So what's with the millennials? When it comes to investing, there's some data suggesting that people who entered the workforce after the turn of the millennium, people in their 20s and 30s now, are somehow risk-averse. Marketplace's senior economics contributor Chris Farrell has been looking into this defamatory assertion. Chris, what is the evidence here?
And it is defamatory, but there is survey after survey from Wall Street that says that millennials are, and I quote, extremely conservative savers, not investors. Another survey found that 46% of millennials, and I quote again, never feel comfortable investing in the stock market. My argument is that millennials have made a big, bold, risky investment. It's in their education.
All right, so they're not risk averse. It's where perhaps you would argue they are choosing to take the risk. And it's what, higher ed?
Okay, so economists at the New York Federal Reserve Bank, they calculate that the total investment on average for a four-year college education is $102,000, which, by the way, explains why so many people are taking on so much debt. The rate of return on that investment, 15%. But what does modern finance tell us, David? If you are earning a high rate of return on an investment, you're also taking greater risk. And the risk is you may graduate at a bad time. You may get a degree which the marketplace doesn't value very much. There's all kinds of intangibles out there that mean a college education is a risky, and I would argue, a bold investment.
But it's not like the millennials are being completely irrational with their actual personal finance outside of higher ed.
No, absolutely not. Rob Arnett, he's this well-known quantitative financier on Wall Street, and he's made a very powerful and important point. He says, look, young adult workers, they lose their jobs a lot. And so he emphasizes that before you start investing or even thinking about investing in stocks, you need 6 months' worth of savings. I think he's right, and we should stop beating up on millennials, but actually say, hey, you know what? They're pretty smart. They're taking a high-risk investment in their future earnings and careers, and they're offsetting it with a conservative investment to ride out job insecurity.
Marketplace senior economics contributor Chris Farrell. Chris, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, David.
And we've been watching the embattled Russian currency as President Putin takes questions from the Russian media in Moscow now. At the moment, the ruble has stabilized day to day. It's about 60 to the dollar, but that's down 45% from where it started the year. In New York, I'm David Brancaccio with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.